Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again.
Unbelievable.
Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake.
A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to this week's episode of the Last Round Podcast, coming off a big boxing weekend from Las Vegas, Nevada at the T-Mobile Arena. We appreciate you guys listening, whether it's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or on Twitter. The last couple months or so, we've been posting full episodes on Twitter. So if you listen to us on Twitter, welcome to the show and thank you for supporting us. This week, a reoccurring guest. I think in comparison to the Ring Magazine editor-in-chief, Doug Fisher, I think Al Dawson is catching up to him in terms of appearances here on the Last Round. So or he's at least closing in on the number of appearances. So we're going to have to go through the archives and double check. But he is with Pro Box TV. He writes for them now. He was previously with The Insider. He just recently joined The Mirror, which is based out of Ireland. So he's a U.S. correspondent for them. And he also does some reporting, some video reporting for Fight Hype. As I mentioned, Al Dawson returns to the Last Round. Welcome back, Al.
Thanks, Danny. Yeah, I'm chuffed to even be number two to Dougie. But yeah, if I've got him in my sights, I'll take him down as well.
Yeah. I think you're getting close. I think you're getting close. We were talking about it couple minutes ago, Mike and I. So you're either right on his tail or you might have passed him. I think you're right behind him though. It's you two at the top right there.
We'll have to get both of us on for the Christmas show. You know, I talked to you, didn't I, last time, Daddy, when Mike wasn't here. But yeah, I want to be involved in that Christmas quiz again.
Yeah. And his quiz in boxing.
Yeah.
He puts a lot of time.
You know, one of my lasting memories from, you know, Christmas last year being on that show. So, yeah, I really want to be on it again.
Yeah, you know, definitely. We'll pencil you in, definitely. And we'll try to find somebody else to for you to go up against. So Dougie Fisher would be good because, you know, he's an encyclopedia for the sport. So that'd be absolutely. But jumping right back into it, fight reviews this past Saturday, the 30th of September from the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas, Nevada. On Showtime pay-per-view, Saul Canelo Alvarez gets the 60th win of his professional career with a 12-round unanimous decision win over Jermell Charlo, who takes the second loss of his career. Alvarez retains his undisputed super middleweight titles at 168 pounds by scores of 118-109 twice and 119-108. Al, you were in the building for this fight and this entire event. Obviously, beginning with Canelo versus Charlo, give us your reaction. What did you think about the result and the overall fight?
I've been lucky enough to see Canelo live three times, and all three have been in Las Vegas. So I was there for the loss to Bivol, the win over Golovkin, and now the win over Charlo. And even watching him on TV, I think that's one of the best performances I've seen from him. You know, you could make an argument, you know, some people have already made the argument that Jermell Charlo didn't really turn up and like Saul just kind of beat who was in front of him. But regardless, I thought he looked amazing. And that's the kind of performance I really, really wanted to see from him. The only thing he didn't really get was the stoppage, but just his general, you know, throwing the right shot at the right time, you know, the body seeking and I wouldn't say I was blown away, but I was really impressed. And I think, I think he really needed a performance like that after, you know, losing to Bivol. Not looking like the Golovkin, I think, was there for him to do this kind of, you know, 118 to 110, 119, you know, like a dominant decision win. I think that, you know, Golovkin should have been the opponent for him to look that good against. And then if he fought John Ryder, say, 2-3 years ago, that's the sort of opponent he would have broken that fighter's bones, you know, like he did with Billy Joe Saunders. But now he's rebounded. Not me, you know, he's got that win now with Jermell Charlo. And I just think it really tees up perfectly, really, the second and the third fight in his three-fight deal with PBC. Just the performance that, you know, I think you know, if you're a Canelo fan, you would have really wanted to see, you know. And even he, like, one thing that kind of warmed my soul, you know, like, you don't normally get this in boxing, but he was smiling on the microphone. He was like, "I'm back. I fucking love boxing so much." It's like, you know, how wholesome is that when people, you know, some fighters say they don't even watch boxing, you know? It's like a love-hate relationship. They do it as a job. And, you know, this isn't Canelo, though. He's still, you know, he's... You know, Eddie Hearn told me last summer that Canelo's got quite more money than God. You know, he gets more money outside of the ring now, surely, than he does inside of it. So he doesn't need to fight, and he probably has just as much fun on the golf course. Yet, you know, he's still kind of blessing his fans with, you know, a walkout that I think sent chills down, you know, Mexican fans in the arena. This is another thing for me. Like, you know, obviously I'm in Las Vegas, and I've been to so many amazing events this year. But the support of Mexican and Mexican-American fight fans is just something amazing to be around. They really, really turn out for their fighters, and just a really fun atmosphere. And also, the one thing I've noticed as well about Mexican-American fight fans, they're in the seats earlier than like what traditional, like other boxing fans turn up. Sometimes they just turn up for the main event. But yeah, they were there for Jesus Ramos as well. And they booed so loud at that result. I know we'll probably get into that later, but they booed so loud at that result that you couldn't even hear in the arena what Erickson Lubin was saying. So yeah, my takeaways are, you know, I love being around the Mexican fight fans, and it's great to see Canelo back. Curious who he fights in his next fight. I thought it was just a great, great, you know, top tier performance, and probably one of his best wins.
Now, Al, do you think in terms of Jermell Charlo's performance, because there's been some, you know, online criticism, just like any big fight, especially a big fight, you know, online criticism for the fans of the sport and all that on Twitter or X or, you know, any type of online forum. A lot of people, you know, fans of the sport criticized Charlo in terms of saying, oh, you know, he felt like he just didn't go for it. Do you think it's more that he didn't go for it, or do you think he felt Canelo's power, and I guess, you know, he was in there pulling it, the skill of Canelo Alvarez, and he just felt like, oh, you know what, this is what it feels like to be in a fight with a guy like this, and
yeah, with a one line,
like, maybe I shouldn't go for it because he's probably gonna get me.
Yeah, he was hitting with the body shots early, so. You know, we've seen Jermell, you know, struggle with Tony Harrison in the first fight and Brian Castaño, and, you know, how easily would Canelo have dealt with those two fighters if they had come up? And this isn't to detract on their talents. It's more about, you know, weight classes exist for a reason. But Jermell was the one to rise to the top of 154 pounds and, you know, 160-pound division is kind of bereft of top tier talent. There's a few guys there, but no one's really on the level of, you know, some of the other divisions we've got in boxing. So, you know, Jermell kind of is rightfully one of the, you know, five guys that could feasibly, you know, fight him at 168. And, you know, though there was, you could see the height difference rather than size difference. You know, there's height differences between two, but height difference, Jermell had height. And I was surprised, actually, that he weighed in at, I can't remember what the precise amount was. It was pretty much the same as Canelo. I was thinking he was going to weigh in at like 163, 164. But yeah, I'm kind of, I think he was just generally put off by just how punishing a Mexican left hook to the body can be. You know, like, yeah, it's just a stereotype in boxing. But, you know, Mexican fighters know how to throw that shot, and when it comes from someone who's got the body structure of Alvarez, who's quite stocky, and yeah, they don't look fun to take. You know, I haven't been in the ring too many times. I've boxed a couple of times in London. I got knocked down once, you know, sparring over a course of like 2 years by a headshot, but you just get up. I felt fine. Whereas, you know, when you're hitting the body by bigger guys that you're sparring with, it's not fun. You know, you can be cursing, you know, for weeks, whereas a headshot, I think you can walk that off, apart from, you know, potentially long-term damage. But with a body shot, you're feeling those for a long time, between 2 weeks if it's bruising or 10 weeks if it's fractured. I could go through my life happy never taking a Canelo body shot, and I think Jermell took about 46 that landed.
So in terms of the, you know, obviously Charlo took the knee. There was a knockdown in the fight, in the latter half of the fight. It looks like it was a delayed knockdown. Alvarez came essentially over the top, got a shot in between the guard. And at least on television, it looked like it was one of those shots that just scrambled the equilibrium on Charlo.
Where did it look like it landed on TV? To me, it looked like it landed right on the forehead.
Yeah. And it just scrambled him. And I think it just, like I said, his equilibrium just kind of went all over the place because it was a delayed. I think he felt it and he tried to stay up. And then he realized, like, oh, you know what? Maybe I should take a knee because I can. I think he just got really dizzy. Is that how it looked from ringside?
Yeah. And I think that's, I'm so glad that if that happened 10, 15, 20 years ago, I remember people calling, you know, on forums, Miguel Cotto, like Niguel, like, you know, because he took, you know, like knee as in spelt.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of glad we're moving away from the like accusing people of quitting or, you know, terminology like this, when really it's a smart thing to do. It's a tactical way of buying yourself more time and, you know, or time to recover. And even if, you know, you still felt dizzy after the eighth second, get up and just take another knee again. You know, if the referee warns you that time, just, you know, you've bought yourself 20 seconds. Jamal only needed to take the knee once, but I'm kind of glad we're moving on as like a boxing fan, boxing media culture, where I mean, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I've seen any criticism of Jermell Charlo or any sort of like, you know, morphing his name to turn into like some sort of, you know, diss, you know, a pun, you know, by taking a knee. Really, it's just a very smart way of buying yourself time. It's much better to do that than try and stay up and trying to be too brave for your own good and then find yourself, you know, knocked down and you're in an even worse way than if you had just taken the knee in the first place. But yeah, that's exactly how it looked to me in the arena. And from that point on, he was just, I think, boxing to hear the final bell. I don't think he really did anything after that point.
Mike, what'd you think about the result?
As expected, to be honest with you, I think, you know, we both picked Canelo last week, and I think we both kind of nailed how he was going to do it as well. You know, kind of like the Callum Smith performance where he just kind of beats him down. You could see he was kind of going sometimes for the arms and stuff like that. I think Charlo took one on the shoulder quite early on in like the first or second round. I think it was the second round, and you could see he was kind of like, okay, like, this guy's pretty powerful. And then after that, I think Charlo kind of tried to survive. And then I think looking back now, he probably regrets it, you know, from looking at the press conferences. I think he openly said, you know, he could have done a lot more in there. But I think it's just easier said than done. You know, if you know that you're going to be in there and open up and try and go for something, and you know that there's a potential you're going to get knocked out, you know, it's easier for us to say it sat here, right, than be in the ring and actually do it. But good performance, I thought, overall from Canelo. I thought it was definitely better than his John Ryder performance, better than the Bibble performance, because obviously, you know, there were, you know, certain parts of the media that said that, you know, he was starting to slip a little bit. And I don't think on that performance, I don't think he is, even though Charlo was obviously the naturally smaller guy. I still think it was a good performance from him. Just could have been rubber stamped, like Al said, with a knockout or some type of stoppage, but Charlo really didn't give him the chance to do it.
Mm-hmm. Al, do you think that Jermell Charlo is the more talented of the Charlo brothers?
Sometimes I say things and I think they sound worse. They sound better in my head than they do when you announce them. But like Jamal right now just isn't, how can we even tell? You know, he's been out of the ring so long and we don't know what version of him there is going to be when he comes back. If indeed he is coming back on late November, I think it's rumored that he's fighting Jose Benavidez on the same card as David Benavidez and Demetrius Andrade, which is quite like that. You know, that's a nice pairing, you know, right, of an event. But, you know, even though you would, if that was the Jamal of 3 years ago, you would think that would be a comfortable win. But yeah, I just really don't know. Like Jamal, I think, was an easier bet, even though he'd been out of the ring also for 14, 15 months. But considering his body of work, you know, how good he is at rematches and, you know, generally his resume, I think, is really good. And like for anyone before the Canelo result who didn't have him in their top 10, I don't know what they're smoking, but I would really like some, you know, because that's crazy. You can't, I just don't think, like, if they weren't branded as PBC events and they were branded as like a World Series Boxing Super Series Classic or something like that, for me, he just went on the Alexander Usyk or Naoya Inoue run, but he did it outside of the World Boxing Super Six. It just so happened that all of the top 154 pounders were at PBC, so the fights were easier to make. Maybe they just didn't get that, you know, the kind of mainstream boxing hype as the, you know, the tournament fighters got when they were rampaging through the divisions. But yeah, he got all those wins, and the only two fighters that he hasn't fought, you know, Tim Tazoo and you know, now really Terence Crawford. But you know, now there's an argument of, does he even deserve a Terence Crawford fight after kind of not really boxing to the standard he could perhaps have fought, you know, or you know, Canelo was just too good. I think no matter what he'd done, no matter what he would have done, Canelo was just, he was on one night, that night. And yeah, I was pretty enthralled with what I was watching. I was kind of waiting, you know, like to watch Canelo live three times and not and leave the arena in those first two times thinking, you know, what is everyone kind of seeing, you know, with this guy live? Is he, you know, I was one of the people who were thinking he was, you know, he'd reached the summit and now he's coming down the other end. But now I feel like he's come up another side. And I still don't think he beats David Benavidez, but I think he beats pretty much everyone else. Yeah, credit to him.
Now, what do you think about you, as obviously as being in the sport, an observer of the sport, because there's a pattern here with, you know, Jermell was out of the ring coming into this fight for an extended period of time. Errol Spence was out of the ring for an extended period of time in the Crawford fight. Fulton, same thing with Inoue. Do you think, you know, because sometimes there's just fighters, whether they're out of the ring or not, when they come in, it's just they know how to turn it on. But do you think overall, from your standpoint and covering the sport for so long, do you think activity matters? You know, maybe if Jermell was just a little bit more active, it kind of would have gave him a better shot at winning?
I think there's kind of a couple of ways of looking at it, because one, in the winners in all of those three fights were always the favourites. Like, I knew it was the comfortable, maybe not the bookmakers, but I always thought, you know, you could have put on a really good, you know, what do you call it, an accumulator bet, where you bet on all those three guys.
Parlay?
Yeah, parlay over here. Yeah, so they were all the favourites, so it's quite hard to tell. But, you know, I think also activity does matter. There's only, like, Floyd got away with it, but he's a generational, it's hard to say how good he is. You know, to me, when he came in the media room yesterday, you know, I loved it. I moved to Vegas too late to cover any part of Floyd's career, but you know, there's a part of me seeing him on stage with Leonard Elby, and he's got like a 17-year-old child, you know, with him, like a kid that looks really young. You know, I'm 39 years old. This 17-year-old looks like a baby face to me, baby faced assassin. But this to me is part of Floyd's legacy. So it's great that I'm now here and I can still cover part of what makes Floyd great. The fact that there's kids who are eight years old 10 years ago, now 17 years old, they came to Vegas because either they watched Floyd or their dad did, and there's just, you know, they want to box and they're just drawn to, you know, someone that looks like them, that they resonate with and they want to sign with. And I think that's like a really, like, you know, really story worthy part of his legacy. But going back to the point, you know, Floyd is one of, you know, a million or one of a billion, and I don't think too many fighters can really come back after that long layoff and do well. And, you know, look at Conor McGregor. He's going to cut, if he comes back and he fights Michael Chandler, that's not going to go well for him. Because, you know, one, he's also not really living the life of an athlete outside of in competition. But as soon as you're not doing that, you know, how many people are still in the sport and getting better and you're then being left behind? There's a, like, I really like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He had this really cool speech. I think it was even in a university in California where it was like, you can't climb the ladder of success with your hands in your pockets. You know, when you're you're out there partying, you know, somebody else is at home getting better than you. And right. I think, you know, that's true in any industry, any business and any sport. You know, there's like Shakur Stevenson, for instance. I don't think he has, you know, to me, he's a future pound for pound number one fighter. And, you know, he's in that top ranked gym over here a lot and he's grinded. Like Terence Crawford as well. He's like the perfect role model for someone like Shakur to have around him. Yeah, I think they live that life just like, you know, Floyd kind of lived that life. And yeah, I don't think you can really be a part-time, you know, I kind of want to say boxer or fighter, but I don't think you can really be a part-time sportsman or sportswoman or athlete really in any discipline and still be, and still expect to be at, you know, the number one in your craft. And yeah, I think there's an argument to make that there's been, I think, 20 Showtime events this year. Yeah, Premier Boxing Champions has one of the deepest rosters in the world. And that's just not enough dates for PBC athletes. You know, that people like the, when you get to the very top level, you need to be fighting, you know, at the very minimum once every 9 months. But then the level below that, where you've still got world champions, need to be, you know, really defending your belt once every 6 months. And then if you're a contender, you should be fighting once every 4 months, maybe. And everyone below that, like prospects and everyone else, should be probably fighting once every 2 months.
Who do you think Canelo fights next in this PBC deal?
I honestly think the money fight is Crawford. Like, it's a stupid fight, but what Crawford just did to Spence and how good Canelo just looked, it's like, you know, bring them together. You know, F it. It seems, you know, it's kind of obvious what's going to happen. But I think you could build towards that, but you could also build towards Benavidez. I think Canelo and Benavidez, maybe is not a stadium fight, at least in Vegas. It probably is in Texas. But I think that would be a wild show on Cinco de Mayo or Mexican Independence Day weekend. I'm kind of thinking boxing should have, for its Mexican fighters, maybe should focus more on Cinco de Mayo, because the UFC Noche show on September 16th here, and I went to that, it was good, but it wasn't a sellout crowd. Last night wasn't a sellout either. And I did speak to Jesus Ramos and Sergio Ramirez about whether boxing should be concerned that UFC wants to take Mexican Independence Day, you know, for itself. And they were saying Mexican fans are loyal and there's enough, you know, Mexican support to go around. But if you, let's say UFC Noche was attended by around 17,500 people. Last night was probably the same. That's 35,000. If they were in different months, they probably would have both been sold out. I think, you know, it just might be that there's not enough Mexican support. It's just here in Vegas, really, to pack out both nights. So if UFC is really going to try and just keep that date for themselves, you know, boxing can still do the same, but maybe don't put as much investment, you know, wanting to get a return on a Canelo event and instead go for your marquee event on Cinco de Mayo. I feel like I've just gone on a massive tangent. What was the actual question? And I'll try and answer it now.
I asked who you thought Canelo would fight in his PBC deal.
Oh yeah, so Crawford, I think, is a money fight. I think Benavidez is the monster, and you know, whether you do that next or try and build up to it, because Benavidez is going to be fighting Andrade in November. You know, who would Benavidez then really fight? Yeah, you could do that in Cinco de Mayo. Those to me are the only two options. Do people really want to see? So when I spoke to, you know, people that would know about like what the PBC strategy was with Canelo, right when they signed him, it was, you know, Jamal, and then Benavidez. But even Canelo, it didn't really matter which brother, you know, they're twins. They both look the same. It's fine. I'll take this one rather than Jamal. I don't, after seeing how easy it was for him against Jamal, I'm not really sure what the appetite would be like. Exactly the same, you know, looking, you know, fighter. Here's his twin, you know, go do the same to him. So I don't think the Jamal fight really has that pizzazz anymore. And I'm not really sure who else there is. I think those are the two obvious bets. And, you know, whether you could do with Crawford, you match him with Jamal. And if Crawford wins, then he's got three of the belts, maybe unifies with the Tim Tazoo Mendoza winner. I keep calling him Tazoo. Tazoo was something that came out this week with
Zoo.
Jamal keeping him So if you got Crawford to be the undisputed champion at super welterweight, and he was undisputed champion at welterweight, and he was undisputed champion at you know, lightweight class two, and then he goes up and he fights the undisputed champ, that's you know, an even bigger way to kind of further build that event. But yeah, it's when you pull the trigger on either of those. I don't know whether they could both happen, because if you do Benavidez and Canelo on Cinco de Mayo, I kind of think Benavidez wins, and then maybe you do the rematch.
Right, right. Yeah, either way, you know, I think Canelo, like you touched on earlier, the criticism that he's been getting, that he's lost a step, from the interviews that he did, especially during fight week, I think that kind of gave him an extra bit of motivation to show the world that he's still the same guy. So sometimes that's what you need for these elite level athletes. For them, it's like, you know, over here for American football, Tom Brady, when he was with the New England Patriots, and then he left, and then they said, oh, he's going to go to another team, it's not going to be the same. Well, he ended up winning another Super Bowl championship. So yeah, sometimes that happens. Sometimes that happens. These elite level guys hear the criticism and they go into a different gear. And in the co-main event of the Showtime pay-per-view event, Mario Barrios gets the 12-round unanimous decision win over Yordanis Ugas. This was for the WBC interim welterweight title. Barrios wins by scores of 118-107 twice and 117-108. I believe Mike did too, but I know I picked Ugas last week. I just thought Ugas still possibly had a little bit left. And especially him being in the ring with Spence, Pacquiao, you know, a little bit more high caliber fighters. But I was completely wrong. What did you think, going into the fight? Who did you think was going to win out? And what did you think of the result?
I only really settled my mind on it when I saw them both, last week, or it might be in the week before, when they were doing open workouts here in Vegas. And I was just around, Barrios, and I just couldn't believe that he fought Tank. Because he's massive,
yeah.
Like even for a welterweight, he's a tall, like he's taller than me. I think he must be like I think I'm 5'11" or something. He must be 6 foot because I feel like I'm looking up at him. Mm. And the fact that I think that's going to turn into one of Tank's best wins, because he is a lot bigger than somebody who's 5'5", and Tank just, you know, dismantled him. And Barrios is now, you know, going through high weight classes and picking up solid wins. So yeah, just seeing him, I thought there was something about him in his open workout compared to Ugas. And by the way, both workouts were probably the worst workouts I've ever seen. Came in shadow box for maybe 20 seconds for literally for a photo, and then they were just kind of hanging around us. But you can sort of tell, you know, what shape they're in and how good they look and things like that. But yeah, it was a pretty bad workout. I've seen some really stinking workouts recently as well. Did you see Francis Ngannou and Mike Tyson?
I think Mike was talking about that, yeah.
Mike Tyson showing Ngannou the like a basic shot, like a jab to the body, and just wondering how well that will work against Tyson Fury. But anyway, digressing. I liked Barrios, and there's something about Bob Santos as well, quality trainer, and you know, what the work he was kind of doing with Hector Luis Garcia last year, it was last year of the Chris Colbert win. He's just got quite a cool crew with him, Bob Santos, and yeah, I feel like we're seeing quite a good, you know, I think we're already seeing the fruits of his work with Barrios as well. So yeah, that was a solid win.
Mike, what do you think about Barrios' win?
Taking nothing away from him. I just didn't know whether it was just Ugas was, you know, kind of obviously 37 now, had that, you know, physically brutal loss to Errol Spence in 2002. And his eye didn't seem to hold up during the fight. You know, he seemed to swell increasingly over the rounds and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, I thought he was going to be in there. I thought he was going to be too weak, too tricky. And just pretty much kind of like old man Barrios and kind of take a points victory over him. Because, you know, before this fight, I didn't really think much of Barrios. He was more of kind of like a weight bully, that he always was, you know, taller, bigger, stronger, would be able to like kind of like refeed and pack on the pounds. And that was why he would normally win, in my opinion. But yeah, I thought he looked pretty good in this. You know, if you're taking nothing away from him, I thought he couldn't seem to miss and just kind of like beat him down. And on that performance, I hope we don't really see Ugas again, because he looks a shadow of the former world champion that we knew.
Yeah, that eye. Right, Al? I mean, you were there. Yeah. You were there in person. And,
yeah.
You know, having back-to-back fights essentially with your eye at the, and it was the same eye, right?
Yeah, it's the same eye. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brutal. He just has that face that just that happens to him.
The doctor inspected it at the end of or between rounds before the 10th, 11th, and the 12th. But you can just kind of see that happening. You know, why if you're an opponent and you get matched with Ugas, why wouldn't you just target that eye with jabs and just you know, until it swells shut and then, you know, score a doctor's stoppage or something? And to avoid that kind of damage, yeah, kind of agreeing with Mike. I think Spence did something to him that might be irreversible, and it might, you know, only get worse the longer it goes. The other thing as well is, like, I kind of made this argument in Boxing News with Joe Joyce. Like, Joyce is well into his late 30s. You can recover from a physical setback in your 20s, but in your 30s it becomes a lot harder to do, and he's right at the end of his 30s. So the fact that he's been, you know, how it's not really that wise to keep on walking through punches, even though for a while he did look like a machine. But I think it's probably time for Joyce to retire, just as much as it is for Ugas, just for the sake of, you know, what is the point for, like, with Joyce, if you can't be the Big Bang Zhang, what level are you going into? And do you really want to be losing to the, you know, between guys and, you know, ranked 8th to 12th? And then if you avoid them, what's the point in going in against, like, Kizora for a final farewell fight? All these are just things, you know, they don't add anything to boxing and they're kind of pointless, and all they do is damage one of the two fighters. So I think, yeah, for both of those guys, Mike's kind of let me down a path, but I'm now attaching Joyce to calling it quits. But yeah, I think when it comes to things like injury and you know, brain trauma from those sorts of knockouts, then it's time to walk away.
Also on the card, Erickson Lubin gets the 12-round unanimous decision win over Jesus Ramos Jr. Lubin wins by scores of 117, 111, 116, 112, 115, 113. Al, you touched on it a few minutes ago at the beginning of the show that there's a lot of Mexican fans, a lot of Latino fans in the building, that they booed the result. They obviously preferred Ramos to win, and they wanted him to win. They felt that he won. On TV, you know, obviously we heard boos throughout the fight. It looks like it wasn't as exciting for the fans in attendance. Do you think Lubin pulled it out? Because those are essentially three different, almost three, well, 116, 112, 115, 113 are kind of pretty close. But what kind of fight did you see ringside?
So I was writing my report as it's going on, and before the results are announced, if it's a distance fight, I've pretty much already written it, and I'm just waiting for the score and for them to say something, so then I can add it to the report, and then I hit send or wherever it's going. So when I heard 115, 113, I was like, Christ, that's closer than what I had it. And then when I heard the other scores, I was like, that's more like it. I'm ready to hear Ramos. And then when I heard Lubin, I just, you know, that wasn't the fight that I saw. You know, might have looked different on TV, but from the viewpoint I had, it didn't look like Lubin did anything. Like, at least Ramos was, you know, doing something. You know, he had the real estate and he was throwing. It didn't look like Lubin was landing with any sort of regularity as much as Ramos. But Ramos didn't look like he was too disheartened with the result. Like, he wasn't, like, saying, it didn't look like it to me, he was protesting too much. I think he said he thought he felt he won, but then he wasn't really, like, screaming from the rooftops, like, oh, I've been jibbed or whatever. And I think he felt like he probably took the last few rounds off. But even if he did, and all of the last, you know, the championship rounds went to Erickson Lubin, he did so much work. You know, he did so much better work for me in the first half of the fight, where he probably won. I didn't score it because I was writing about it. You know, I feel like if you're scoring a fight, you shouldn't be writing about the fight. If you're writing about the fight, you're probably doing something else, looking down, tapping away. You might have missed, you know, some quality work. You look up. But to me, it did look like he'd, you know, in my head, I was thinking he's won at least five of these first six or seven rounds. So he would have had to have lost every single round then to get that 115, 113. It just wasn't the fight I saw.
Was that comment on media row right there ringside from your colleagues?
Yeah, people are like, yeah, I was turning around going, you know, what the F was that? And yeah, I think Dan Raphael, he was sitting next to me in the media room after, you know, back in the press conference. Yeah, he thought it was an outrage. And it was actually quite split, actually. Tris Dixon, I think, saw a lot closer fight, and I don't think he felt it was an injustice either way. It definitely wasn't a robbery. Like, I think robbery gets thrown around so much. Robbery is when someone, who scored the Canelo Mayweather fight to a draw? That's, you know, that. Yeah. The result went the right way, but that's the sort of, you know, BS. That was a shutout. And then, you know, how can you give six rounds to someone that didn't deserve even, like, you know, two or one? But, yeah, I wouldn't go as far as maybe I wouldn't say it was a bit of a robbery. It just wasn't the fight I saw. Ramos won, Lubin lost, but somehow Lubin's got the W, and now he's going to be... it's just baffling, that decision, because sometimes you think a score like that would go the way of, you know... the home guy, in this case that's Ramos, or the promoter guy. The promoter's got both, but really it's in PBC's interest to if Ramos was losing, to give him the win, because, you know, he's like 22 years old, good looking, talks to the media well, he's got fans, you know, they're all in the arena cheering for him. Yeah, he's got loads of upside. You know, Leonard Ellerby was telling me this week, you know, he thinks he's the real deal. So he's got a lot of, like, industry praise. You know, it seems like he had the momentum, really. But yeah, it's just a weird result. And just talking to you now, I still can't get my head around it. I probably need to watch it back. But yeah, to me, it really did not seem like a unanimous decision to Lubin. When I heard those scores, I really thought this is a straightforward Ramos win. But that 115, 113 is too close for me. Well, what did you guys see?
What do you think, Mike?
I mean, I thought it was a shutout for Lubin. 120, 108.
No way.
No, I thought Ramos took it. I thought he could have done more and, like, kind of rubber stamped it a bit. You know, I thought he could have, you know, kind of took his foot off, I think, towards the end. And Lubin, I think, you know, his trainer, Kevin Cunningham, was telling him in the corner, like, you need to throw more, you need to do more, because the fight wasn't really, like, no one really took a hold of it and was like, okay, like, I'm ahead, I'm going to put my foot on the gas and I'm going to run away with this fight. And I think that was the problem that Ramos had, and that's why it was, you know, so close in the end. Yeah, and I agree with what I was saying. It's kind of surprising, because normally when it's close like that and they kind of, like, F up the scorecards, it's always in favor of the home fighter, you know, the fight that they want to win. And obviously, you know, Ramos is like 22 years old, PBC guy, undefeated. So you think the scorecards really would have gone that way. And it was, you know, kind of like the, you know, Mexican Heritage Month, right? You know, like.
Yeah.
So you think they would have gone that way instead of going, obviously, towards Lubin. So, yeah, it was kind of a surprise, but still a good performance from Ramos, I think, because Lubin was kind of made it a little bit tricky. He was a little bit elusive. Kind of similar to Charlo, he wouldn't really get, like, involved in the mix because he knew that Ramos was the bigger, stronger fighter. So he was kind of a little bit hard to nail down. But it's a learning curve for Ramos. I think, you know, PBC rate him, like Al said. So I think I could see him coming back out, like, pretty quick, like 2 or 3 months, they'll stick him back out and he'll get a win back in the column and then, you know, kind of build on to bigger and better things in 2024.
The thing that was like... So Jermell Charlo knocked him out in a single round. Sebastian Fundora had that fight of the year with him early last year. And just his face, just it looked like Lubin should have gone. I think he did go. He definitely went to the hospital after that. But it looked like his face was broken. Luckily, it wasn't. But his face looked like he'd been hit with bats. But, you know, why didn't we see that from Ramos? You know, why couldn't he go anywhere near what Sebastian Fundora or Jermell Charlo did? Granted, Jermell Charlo went on to unify the division, but Sebastian Fundora is kind of, I wouldn't say leveled out, but he's had, he hasn't had those highs since then. You know, does it take off away from, you know, Jesus, you know, do we need to temper the hype for Jesus Ramos a little bit?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I could see a rematch happening maybe sometime next year. I mean, Lubin's obviously going to try to fight maybe a Charlo or somebody, you know, bigger fight for him, but I could see these two eventually running it back probably sometime next year. So I could definitely see it. Also on that card, Elijah Garcia remains undefeated at 16-0 with the 8th round TKO over Jose Armando Resendez. This is for the WBA Intercontinental Middleweight title. And also Frank Sanchez, a heavyweight matchup, remains undefeated as well at 23-0 with the decision win over Scott Alexander. Frank Sanchez obviously trains with the Canelo camp. He had left for a bit when Ryan Garcia left, and I think he followed suit with Joe Goosen over here in Los Angeles. But then I think he realized maybe I need to go back, and then he went back with the Canelo team to keep training with Eddie Reynoso. And then also on the card, the Nail, Alexander Gvozdik. I'm pretty sure I pronounced that wrong. Returns. I feel like he's been around for a long time. Gets the second round KO over Isaac Rodriguez. These heavyweights out, Frank Sanchez, the Nail. Where do you think they go in the future?
I mean, I still don't see them as ready for like the, you know, the top level, which is annoying because the top level can't even sort itself out yet. Well, apart from Fury and Usyk, that actually got agreed, but it's one of those things because it fell apart earlier in the year. You're wondering, you know, until Fury goes and does whatever he's going to do with Ngannou, you know, he's basically got to leave that fight without barely a scratch on him because there's only 6 or 7 weeks before, you know, he's supposed to fight Usyk if they're going to do that December 23rd. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not too sold on any of the heavyweights I saw on the undercard. The person I really liked was Kermell Moten, you know, the 17-year-old protege from Floyd Mayweather's, you know, Mayweather Boxing Club.
He fought after the main event, right?
Yes. I thought he was going to be the third. You know, that like, you know, I thought he was going to take, you know, his match was going to start about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. It looked like he was quite early on the bout sheet. But like you guys have probably seen, a bout sheet doesn't mean anything.
It does,
you know, this, like you think you're looking at the first fight, turns out to be the fourth, and then they go for the second, and it's quite chaos a lot of the time. So yeah, Leonard Ellerbe said they wanted to put Kermell, they were going to save Kermell for the walkout bout, and it was going to be straight after Canelo, so that there was more fans in the ring. That's fine. I think, to be fair, there probably were more fans still then than there would have been if he was the last on the prelims, so that, you know, people streaming, you could watch it if you were at home. And I think that, you know, from what I saw, granted it was 90 seconds, how much can you really, you know, assess someone? But he just had, even from his stance alone, the way he, you know, planted his feet and then throw shots, and just how the way that he was about to throw a shot, it was just very, like, predatory and smooth, fast, athletic. The way he could just accelerate through, throw a left hook, knock the guy down, just didn't let him off the hook after that. I liked what I saw. And the fact he's only 17, I can't get my head around how young he looks. I really want to see him again and again. I'm going to try and definitely get down to the Mayweather gym and, you know, just watch him spar and... I really like the I actually think Leonard Ellerbe, I've said it on Twitter a few times. You know the way people rate Samson Lukovic for his, you know, ability, right, to just find people. That's exactly how I think Leonard Ellerbe is with, and Floyd. You know, the way that they can, because they don't sign many fighters. They're not like you know, top rank PPC Matchroom, maybe even Golden Boy to a certain extent. I think there's probably only 25 fighters at Mayweather Promotions. Mm-hmm. They're quite particular with who they, you know, they purposely go for, you know, the smaller sort of boutique size roster. But then they've got so many, you know, Robert Meriwether III. I think he had 2 fights in Mexico, and then he had his first fight in America December 16th, I think, last year. And it was after, that was a walkout bout, actually. That was after Frank Martin beat Michelle Rivera. And Merriweather, who was only 17 at the time, walked to the ring with a crown. You know, and he's 17 years old and he had all this swag and confidence. And he did exactly the same thing as kind of what Kermel did, where he just, like, you know, ball rushed his opponent. They've got Jalil Hackett, who's, I don't think he's a teenager anymore. I think Jalil's probably 20. And then they've got Dorian Khan. But these four guys, I think they're all future world champions. I think they're all future stars. I honestly think they're, I don't think there's anyone more exciting, you know, at a teenage level in world boxing than the four, you know, as a group. You know, I'm not saying, you know, someone might have a really hot, you know, 19-year-old, but if you, when you've got four of those guys, they're all American. You know, they're based here. I think some of them are in Washington, but they come over for camps. But, you know, Kermel is a Vegas kid, and I think so is Robert Merriweather. They, you know, moved here just to literally be around Floyd and Leonard. And I think it's going to be a really, the ongoing story potential for, you know, the new, you know, whatever, however people roll with it, whether it's going to be the new Floyd or the new Javonte Davis or however the way people want to headline it, I think people are going to have a lot of fun with seeing these four athletes come through. And Kermel is definitely someone I want to see fight again and again and again.
Yeah, yeah, they got a nice young crop of fighters right there that, you know, if they all turn out to be what they hoped to expect, that'd be great. Even if one of them turns out.
Yeah, even if one is a massive success. You know, there's a bit of hype, of me hyping it up, saying all four. But yeah, I think they all look the goods, you know, and the respect level that, especially Jalil, but he's probably the more advanced along in his career than all the others. But, you know, Javonte Davis, that's his preferred sparring partner. I don't know many sparring partners that can go 15 rounds with Javonte Davis. And yet Jalil Hackett's done it, you know, multiple times. And even when you speak to other people, you know, industry insiders, yeah, they're kind of blown away by Jalil. But yeah, it just seems like, you know, Dorian's going to be next, and then Robert Merriweather, and then Kermel coming up right after him.
Absolutely. And then also this past weekend from the Wembley Arena in London on DAZN, for the IBF cruiserweight title of the world, Jayo Pattaya gets the fourth round TK over Jordan Thompson. And then also from Turkey this past weekend, another heavyweight matchup, Otto Wallin gets the 26th win of his career with a split decision over Murat Gassiev. Out in terms of Otto Wallin, you know, obviously he got a lot of publicity and a lot of attention for his fight against Tyson Fury, which I believe was in Las Vegas. Even though he lost that fight, you know, he did a lot. I think he cut Tyson Fury. There was a cut over Tyson Fury's eye or something. Do you think that is pretty much the ceiling for Otto Wallin? Do you think that's his highest point in his career? Or do you think he's going to maybe get that one last big fight against another big heavyweight in the future?
Depends whether he could sort of argue whether he could, you know, if Tyson Fury wanted to, I mean, lay up is too strong a word. If he wanted like a stay busy fight or something like that, that's, I can't see what else he's going to get. I think everyone else in the heavyweight division just would see Wallin as a, you know, why. It's a shame that he couldn't get the rematch more like quicker, because if that was in a different commission, maybe that would have gotten stopped, because there was a lot of blood.
Right.
He's not really been able to replicate that in any good way since then.
Mike, what'd you think about Otto Wallin's win here?
Good win over someone, you know, as big as Murat Gassiev, and going out to it's not Murat's backyard, but going out to Turkey and getting a win over someone like that. Good, really. I mean, Wallin has just carried on winning, you know, ever since facing Tyson Fury. He just come back, and, you know, his management team have a good relationship with Eddie Hearn. So I could see him in there, maybe not even with someone like AJ or Fury, but I could see him in there with like a Dillian White, a Chisora, kind of like that next level below, because like Al said, you know, he's a good fighter, but he's kind of like, do you really need him? Because he doesn't bring a lot to the table. You're not going to fight Otto Wallin and get the highest purse of your career, but you're going to get a hard fight. So it's kind of, you have to kind of weigh it up, unfortunately. You know, that's just, it's not like the UFC where Dana White just tells you, like, you're fighting this guy, and, you know, it's either that or nothing. So, yeah, he's kind of in a tricky position. You know, such a good performance against Tyson Fury has actually ruined his career.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? It's interesting to look at it like that. But sometimes, you know, could you say the same thing about Bivol, kind of? You know, Bivol got the biggest win of his career, Canelo, and then fought Zerto Ramirez and beat Ramirez. And you thought, oh, okay, he's gaining some momentum. You know, he's been waiting for, you know, this type of pathway for a while. But ever since then, you know, we really haven't heard anything from Bivol because, you know, he's so good, but his talent exceeds his box office draw. And, you know, that we've seen over history in fighting that those kind of fighters, it's hard for them to secure the big fights. So, you know, it is what it is. And fight preview this upcoming Saturday, the 7th of October from the Sheffield Arena in Sheffield on DAZN for the WBA Featherweight Championship of the World. Lee Wood, 27-3, goes up against Josh Warrington, 31-2-1. Al, what do you think about this matchup for the Featherweight Championship?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be honest, I haven't paid too much attention to the British scene since I've moved here. But I think it's a combination of one, there's a lot going on here, but two,
Mike's shaking his head at Al because they're fellow countrymen right now.
I don't think the British scene's got much to offer. Like,
oh, this guy. look at him. Moves to America, forgets where he's from. How do I kick him out? How do I kick him out the zoo?
But who have we got, Mike, who, like Anthony Joshua, you know what we're saying about Canelo coming down the mountain and maybe Jermell makes it like there's another peak, maybe. I don't get the impression that Anthony Joshua's got another peak. Tyson Fury, he can't fight in America because he, like, as far as we're aware, he's still not allowed in the country because of his association with Daniel Kinahan. And Josh Taylor never took off. Like, he was like, it's funny because if you speak to him, like in media, like I've had one-on-one interviews, he's like quite a nice guy. And I say to him, you know, you're like a bit of a bastard, you know. You've got a reputation as a real bastard. So, like, you know, and he was like, yeah, you know, what are you going to do? But, you know, I quite like the fact that he's always so, like, he's always ready for a ruck, that guy. Like, he is a born fighter, Josh Taylor. But that never, how did that not resonate with more, you know, mainstream audiences? You know, there were issues on the streets of Edinburgh, I think, where there was, I want to say, alleged racism. So, like, maybe that just put off people. So, like, Josh Taylor could have been a kind of big Scottish star or British star, but never really took off. But yeah, since the days of like Carl Froch, Kell Brook, Amir Khan, you know, and then you go back a little further. I mean, even Tony Bellew, David Hay, Ricky Hatton, Joe Calzaghe. Where are all these guys now? You know,
what do you think, Mike? Is he right?
Who has British boxing got coming through?
No, he's 100% right. I was actually going to say that if he didn't say that. In terms of like they've never replaced that kind of Eddie Hearn initial Matchroom stable that like me and Al probably grew up with, like Kell Brook, Amir Khan, Carl Froch, all those guys. They used to do, you know, like really good numbers. But yeah, ever since then, you know, because you could kind of see that he was going to build off the Olympic teams, you know, constantly. I thought that was going to be the cycle. But then obviously coming through next, you got AJ, no one else really. And then obviously the ones after that, I don't think anyone really jumped out of the scene and did anything. Maybe Lawrence Okoli a little bit. You know, I don't think he's, you know, like massively loved by everybody. His story of, you know, working in McDonald's and then becoming a world champion, but he didn't resonate over here. But yeah, in terms of that, I was 100% right. I don't think we've managed to get anywhere near the amount of attention that group did.
I've got one exception that I've just thought of, who I actually am a bit annoyed I didn't think of this earlier, because I actually really like him. I've spoken to him a few times, been really gracious with his time. But Chris Eubank Jr., and he just, you know, that was a really good win of his coming back. You know, it could be the exception that disproves the rule, whatever the saying is. You know, why have rematches? You know, Terence Crawford's already battered Errol Spence. What's he gonna do in the rematch? But you know, Chris Eubank Jr. didn't look like he would do anything in that do-over, and then he kind of won absurdly good But the thing with Eubank is that I don't think he did enough, you know, when he was here. He was with PBC for a while, and, you know, they kind of was an attempt to build a perhaps a rivalry with, I think it was Jamal rather than Jamal. Mm. But I get the impression Chris Jr. is going to just kind of stay in the UK scene, which makes me think that Conor Benn fight is more likely than not. And it's a bit of a sad state of affairs if that's the only kind of super fight that British boxing can offer now, when it's Chris Eubank Jr., who I think should be a star and deserves to be one, because, you know, when Conor did test positive, you know, with the two drug tests, and it was kind of, you know, hidden for a while, and then the only reason the fight got cancelled was because it was leaked somehow to the Daily Mail. The only person who came out of that looking good was Chris Eubank Jr., because all of the promoters, including Eubanks, Cali Sauerland, they all wanted to go ahead with the fight. What's Chris going to do? Say no. You know, he's a fighter. So, you know, he's naturally going to say yes. But this way he handled himself throughout that whole affair, you know, Eddie Hearn didn't come out of it looking very well, and he still doesn't look very good now. Conor Benn certainly didn't come out at the time well, and he looks even worse now. And Cali Sauerland, you know, wanting his fight just to go ahead with, you know, an opponent who had already tested positive for, you know, performance enhancing drugs on two separate tests. He wanted to pursue and put him in the ring with somebody who, you know, potentially had stuff still in them, in their system. So yeah, he came out of it looking awful. But yeah, Chris was pretty much the only one who came out looking like a professional, and he's still looking pretty pro now. There was also, didn't he, I'm sure Liam Smith said something about, you know, he was trying to out him as a homosexual, you know, on the stage. And Chris's whole response was just really classy, you know. So the amount of times where he could have, you know, said something back and, you know, matched, you know, when you go low, you know, when somebody goes low, maybe you go low. He's never done that. So I've always respected Chris Jr. So I feel like he should be a star. But, you know, if the only super fight for him in British boxing is Conor Benn, and that's the only, you know, you can see why they want that to happen, because there's nothing else going on that can generate that amount of money. I'm not sure that could sell out. I really don't think that's going to sell out Wembley, but that's bigger than an O2 Arena fight. That could probably do well at the Amex Stadium, the Brighton Stadium, where Chris Eubank's from. So he could have it at his home stadium. I don't know where Conor Benn's from. Well, he's from Essex, isn't he? I'm not sure what stadium you could do it in. Maybe West Ham. They've had, it's not even a stadium anymore, is it? So they moved to the Olympic Stadium. Either way, it's probably a stadium fight, but it's probably like a mid-tier soccer football ground rather than a national one. But that's all British boxing's got. That, you know, the fact that they're pushing so hard for Nigel Benn is because they've got nothing else, I think. That's just how it looks like. You know, I'm in America now. Granted, I'm not paying too much attention to the British scene, but I definitely would be if it was a lot better. The reason I'm kind of not too tuned into it is because, like, I think it's quite... compared to what we've got here,
right,
it's not very good.
I hope we don't lose a lot of fans over across the pond because of this conversation.
I think
I'm a fan of British boxing. I'm a fan. I don't know about these guys. I'm a fan. So listen to the show, at least for me.
Boxing right now, I've got higher expectations, though. You know,
right.
all those fighters we listed off earlier, you know, I grew up on... So when I was seven, Prince Nassim, that's who got me into boxing, seeing him like storm the, like, you know, walk to the ring in the entrances that he did, fight in the styles that he did. But we always had a conveyor belt of top tier, for me, Hall of Fame worthy fighters. You know, Naz is in the Hall of Fame. I keep voting for Ricky Hatton. He's not in there yet. He should be a Hall of Famer, because how can you not have a crowd in your country, in the palm of your hand? You take them around the world and they come with you, and they're walking along singing a song in a Ricky Hatton wonderland, you know, and you're making some of the best events of the time. You know, the best HBO 24/7 was probably him and Floyd, right? That was probably the best HBO, when Floyd's going to Manchester and he's wearing a Manchester United shirt in a, you know, Manchester City area, you know, and Ricky is kind of, you know, you've got the guy that's the money guy, and you've got the blue collar, you know, factory, you know, the regular guy that Ricky always was. Carl Froch just got in the Hall of Fame. You know, we should have our expectations there. Britain can produce, you know, quality fighters who turn into stars. So maybe my, like, I'm not saying it's the fighters. I'm more looking at the networks and the promoters and the matchmakers that probably aren't doing these fighters justice.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can see it. I'll give you guys defended the position well. Some people might not like it, but hey, I'll defer to your guys' opinion on this one. It's 2-1. And also this upcoming weekend from the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas, once again on DAZN. Al, I believe you'll be in attendance for this one
as
well.
Here we go. American boxing. Yeah.
American boxing. Back to it on this stateside. Gilberto Zurdo Ramirez, 44-1, goes up against Joe Smith Jr. This is a Golden Boy promotions card on DAZN. We talked about this just before we came on air. Al, what do you think about this matchup?
Yeah, I like it's not, it's a level or two below the super fights we've seen in Las Vegas, but it's a type of match I don't think needed. They could have gotten away with not making this fight, and I think it's a really good, even though it's in an unfamiliar weight class for both guys. I like the fight, and it can, you know, cruiserweight's quite kind of a more of an. I think these guys can make a move in this weight class more so than they can make a move at light heavyweight where they're blocked by Beterbiev and Bivol. So I like it that it might help create, you know, potentially someone who can go a little bit further. I think it's at a catch rate, but the, you know, it's still a catch rate within the cruiserweight weight class. And this is where both guys, I've spoken to them both. I think it looks like they're both there to stay, particularly Zurdo. So he was a super middleweight champion 3 years ago, right. Stayed at light heavyweight for a very short period of time. Now he's at cruiserweight, and it's like he was saying, he's probably going to be a heavyweight in like 3 years.
Right.
That guy's a big dude.
Yeah, he's huge.
Yeah. How did he make super middleweight? Because he was linked, I was speaking to him, you were linked with Canelo, because I was like saying, what do you think of the Canelo fight this weekend? You were previously linked with him. And I started thinking how ridiculous it would be to see them two in the ring now.
Right. Yeah, the size difference.
But yeah, I like this fight, and I don't think I've seen Golden Boy. Well, they were here for the Tank Ryan Garcia fight, obviously, but I mean like a whole Golden Boy show. I don't think they've been here since I've been here in Vegas. So I'm looking, like, in the Cosmopolitan, I'm presuming it's in the Chelsea Theatre. It's about like a 2,500 capacity arena. The Cosmo is awesome. If you're going to stay in Las Vegas, maybe not during during this event, it would be fine. The rooms will probably still be a fine price, but yeah, you can have a good lot of fun in the Cosmopolitan. I've seen quite a few good fights there. I'm sure. That's where Hector Luis Garcia beat Chris Colbert. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Mike, what do you think about this matchup, and who do you think pulls it off at the end?
Good matchup. Kind of came out of nowhere, to be honest with you. I think I'd like to see Joe Smith Jr. win. I just think he's a little bit more professional than Ramirez, who's kind of like missed weight, turned down fights. You know, left the top rank, came to Golden Boy and stuff like that. Just kind of picked and choosed his career a little bit, where I think Joe Smith Jr. has kind of come up the old-fashioned hard way of no one really knew who he was until he, you know, knocked out, you know, Hopkins out of the ring, and then he kind of like burst onto the scene and kind of managed to stay there. And he was kind of like a blue-collar worker, right? Because he was still cutting down trees and had a business with his dad of like tree trimming, you know, over on the East Coast. So, yeah. I have more of an affection towards him, and I'd like to see him kind of get back into the win column and beat someone like Gilberto Ramirez. I think it'd be a good victory for him, but you know, I think it's going to be tough because Gilberto's going to come in huge like he always does. But
right.
I think Joe Smith will take it. I think he's just the harder guy. I think Gilberto will kind of go missing when it turns into a tricky, hard fight. I think that old phrase, if Joe Smith can like drag him into deep waters, I think he'll win.
Yeah, it's an intriguing fight. So it is an intriguing fight. I think Ramirez is going to pull it off. So I'm going to have to disagree with you on here, but I think Ramirez is going to pull it off. But
how close to a world championship like possibility, or do you, you know, whoever wins, do you think they could be a cruiserweight world champion?
Well, I mean, I think we all know cruiserweight isn't really, you know, the luxury division as other divisions in the sport. So I think that for either of them, you know, maybe after this fight, it'd be easier to make a they can go straight into a cruiserweight world title shot just because it's, you know, like I say, it's not luxurious to be in that division. So, you know, it, for either of them, especially for Ramirez being with Golden Boy, you know, he can get a world title shot. And if he can get the cruiserweight title, then they say, oh, we have a world champion under our banner, under our stable, you know, promoters. So, yeah, I and then we talked about the weight, especially with Ramirez. Like, we were just all surprised how he made 168 just a couple of years ago. And then he had some unfortunate weight cuts at 175. And you know, I believe, like you said, this is at a catch weight. So, yeah, I think I wouldn't be surprised if either of these guys, especially if it's Ramirez, just because obviously he's got a multi-fight deal with Golden Boy, gets a title shot sometime in 2024 in his next fight. So I'd be surprised if he doesn't, just because the cruiserweight division isn't really that deep.
Well, I'm just waiting for the first person to throw as much money as they can at Badu Jack. You've guaranteed pretty much.
He always pops up, doesn't he? He always pops up.
He's holding the WBC cruiserweight world title, isn't he? And if I was a promoter, I would just throw money at him because he's the weak link. The dude's, how old is he now? He's
40?
He must be 39. He's been
for a while.
39? So, I think either of those two would give him a run for his money and then obviously pick up the WBC world title. According to BoxRec, the WBA normal is vacant. And the WBA super world title is Arsene Goulamerian. And then obviously you've got Chris Billam-Smith in the UK, but obviously all UK fighters are trash, so there's not anyone would be.
I think Billam-Smith and who there's a Aussie that won, Jay Olapetai.
Yeah.
Like that would be a fight.
Yeah, I could see that. They're coming back, guys. Britain Boxing is coming back. Just give it a couple of years. You know, we're going to revisit this exact conversation again and again until they get your approval once again, guys. I'm telling you.
If they were fighting in Al's backyard, Al would shut the curtains.
In Vegas?
Just get out of my pool.
Shut the curtains. Call the police.
And in the news and notes section of this week's episode, The Last Round, we touched on this just a bit throughout the show earlier. Tyson Fury and Alexander Usyk have signed contracts for an undisputed heavyweight championship fight in Saudi Arabia. I don't think they've announced a date yet, but they're thinking December, end of December, maybe just before the holidays. Is that correct, Al?
Yeah, it sounded like this week, because I've been around Top Rank a few times. It sounds like whatever happens in the Ngannou fight, if he comes out clean as a whistle, then they'll do the date. They'll pull the date forward a little bit. But if he's, you know, you never know what happens. If he gets like a little nick and it needs, you know, you can't spar for a while, or if you spar, you know, that's when I think it would go into January. But it's kind of interesting timing of the announcement, because when we were there for the, they scheduled it for the same time as the grand arrivals for Canelo. So, cause in my head, I was like, I'm going to be around, I've already spoken to Canelo, I went to Los Angeles a few weeks back. So I kind of had material. I knew I'd be able to speak to Jamel on like the Wednesday, Thursday. So I chose to go to the Ngannou and Mike Tyson. How often are you really going to be around Mike? And, well, the second best mic in boxing anyway. We've got the best mic right here. So I chose to go to the Ngannou. But so obviously there wasn't that many boxing media there. It was mainly, you know, I recognised more faces from the MMA side. But from what I heard from, you know, later in the week, from they weren't too impressed with, you know, the numbers that, you know, those media channels were getting from the content capture and, you know, the workout videos and, you know, the numbers that these videos were generating that they were publishing. So I'm just curious if they're, you know, throw in this carrot of, you know, this is the fight that then leads to, you know, the big one that we all, you know, want to see, undisputed. And, you know, we can either see Usyk become an all-time great or Fury. Really, the stakes on that are massive, because if Fury wins, it doesn't really matter if he doesn't fight Joshua, because Joshua's not a threat to Tyson Fury. You know, the threat for a while was Deontay Wilder, just because he's like, even still, he's knocked down everyone he's ever faced. And if you've had 44 fights, that's a hell of a accomplishment to be able to still hold, you know, hang your hat on. And Usyk is the one who could. I personally, I just think Tyson's too big to not win. But still, the stakes are massive because whoever wins, like if Tyson Fury wins, you know, he's easily a top 10 boxer of heavyweight of all time. And if Usyk wins, he becomes better than, you know, historically speaking, than Evander Holyfield. He had, you know, the two cruiserweight careers, you can, I think people would probably be split. You just have them one or one A and one B or one or two. And, you know, there's probably no right answers. But if Usyk goes and beats Tyson Fury, he for me, has done better things than Evander Holyfield did, because Evander Holyfield never really he was never really the number one heavyweight in his era, right? Lennox Lewis was another great Brit from the past that we don't have. But yeah, so if Usyk beats Fury, he's the number one heavyweight of the era. Whereas if you know, if you the fight's massive, the fight is great, you know, like, but
were you surprised that it was, because it kind of just came out of nowhere.
That's why I think that the numbers for the Ngannou Fury, they might have been thinking they were going to be better than they are. They might still become decent. But, you know, from what we were seeing so far of Ngannou's boxing, like, great striker in MMA. But even though he had boxing background in Paris before he got into, you know, MMA, came into the UFC in America, it still seems like Conor McGregor was the better former boxer going into MMA. You know, Conor McGregor still learned to box at Crumlin Boxing Club, you know, when he was a teenager. He was still, you know, doing things in a boxing ring, obviously not as much as he was doing in a, you know, grappling mats or an MMA cage, straight blast gym. But he was still, you know, he was going into the Floyd Mayweather fight, at least with someone who had boxed, you know, on and off in gyms. Granted, he didn't have anywhere near the level of fights or talent needed to take on Mayweather, but I don't think Ngannou has got anywhere near what Conor McGregor had. And, you know, it's not the fight I wanted to see Ngannou in at heavyweight. Deontay Wilder or Joshua, either one, that you want the puncher against, you want the threat of, like, he's not going to knock out Tyson Fury, surely. So what's the, it's just a weird fight that I didn't ask for. And it's, I just think it's the strangest one of the big three to have made. You know, maybe obviously it's the one that made most financial sense for Ngannou, but you can't do it again. Let's say if he fought Wilder and he landed one punch, but Wilder still won. You know, you'd be like, oh, maybe he could land that on Joshua. You know, he could do it. You know, he could do it. Like if Tyson Fury just goes in and embarrasses him, which he will do, and then he can't carry him surely for 10. I think it is scheduled for 10 rounds. So if he carries him for 8 and then knocks him out, I think it's just easier to get him out of there in a round. But yeah, part of, I just think, like you say, it came out of the blue. And yeah, the cynic in me just thinks it's the carrot to dangle us to make us more interested in, you know, the kind of glorified exhibition that's going to go on October 28th in, is it Riyadh season? I think it's called.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's true though. It could be something just to kind of get people more interested in tuning in to the Ngannou Fury fight. So we will see.
I did have news that I wanted to bring up because it was, we've mentioned it on the show before, and I found out. And whenever I'm mentioning it to Dana White, I keep on thinking of you guys because we talked about I can't remember which show it was. I'm sure it was about, it might have even been the Christmas one, and we were talking about WWE. Then chairman, I think Stephanie McMahon. What was her?
Yeah. What do you got? Because I know, obviously, for people who don't know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners know WWE, UFC, Endeavor merged. They are now called TKO, I think, on TKO, the American stock holding, market. Yeah. So what do you got? What do you got here, Al?
Well, as soon as that merged, you know, I was at a press conference with Dana White, and I was just saying, you know, you've got the market leader in professional wrestling and WWE, you've got the market leader in MMA and UFC all under one roof. You know, is there room for a boxing division? And he said, you know, considering Stephanie McMahon has said she wants to get into boxing, considering Dana White's dabbled with the idea of Zuffa boxing, and he said yes. But he was very, like, he paused for like a weird amount of seconds before eventually saying yes. It was like he didn't really want to give too much away. So I said, would you buy a company? Because, you know, Bob Arum has said before, if the price is right, he would consider selling his portion of or part of his portion in Top Rank. You know, and even, I think he even said anything is for sale. Oscar De La Hoya said he would sell Golden Boy for $1 billion. I don't think the company is even worth that much. But, you know, I think, you know, you know, I'll hate you. It makes sense to buy PBC if PBC is for sale. You know, maybe it's not, but for me, PBC is a boxing leader this year. They've put on the best fights. They've got the best roster. They've got the most amount of box office stars by far. You know, if you're talking about Canelo on contract, Crawford, you've still got Spence, Gervonta Davis, Deontay Wilder, Charlo Brothers, David Benavidez. You know, so that my question was, would you buy a company or create your own? And, you know, again, he was silent for a while and said he'd create one. And I was like, in my head, I was like, this is, you know, good information. You've only given me two words, though. So I didn't really, you know, I wanted more. So I just said, can you elaborate? And he said, he laughed and said, no. But anyway, 2 weeks passed. And then Tom Loeffler announced that Callum Walsh is going to be fighting at the theatre at the Madison Square Garden in New York on the Thursday. And then Bill Burr is going to be in the Madison Square Garden, the big room, on the Friday. And then UFC is going to be there on the Saturday. So it's quite, you know, curious timing, the fact that Callum Walsh, obviously, he's sponsored by Howlerhead Whiskey. Dana White loves him anyway. He's even been to one of Tom Loeffler's shows. So again, I asked Dana White, you know, I was kind of getting there with like, you're investing so much time in Callum Walsh, one of the few boxers you really kind of, you know, he's interested in boxing, but he's actually got an investment in Callum Walsh because Howlerhead is his brand. You know, so eventually said, is Callum Walsh going to be a part of TKO? You know, is he going to be a boxer, you know, in TKO boxing? And Dana White, he was like, you know, he's smiling and being like, well, hypothetically, you could assume, you know, it was obvious that you know, that could be the first boxer that becomes a part of, you know, UFC, WWE, TKO group.
So staying on that subject, there's obviously been reports, it's been for a couple of years, but, you know, the last month or so, especially this last couple of weeks, there's been reports about Showtime kind of going the HBO route. The HBO in 2018, they got out of the boxing business. I know Steven Espinoza, that he answered some questions about it throughout fight week and all that. You know, what have you heard, Al, you know, about, is there any writing on the wall? Is Showtime going to exit the boxing business? Because if that does happen, what we just talked about, you know, if PBC, Al Haymon, you know, his fighters become free agents or whatever they may become, because he's an advisor, manager, maybe Dana White, you know, swings in with TKO and is like, hey, well, now this place is out of business. Let's see if we can work with these fighters that are available.
So I think if you speak to PBC, they're really bullish. I've heard since, I don't think it's all year, but I've heard a lot this year that they're like, I keep saying, oh, you're having a great year. You know, what's next? Can we have, you know, what's next for Benavidez? You know, trying to get, you know, where's your next pay-per-view coming? And all the way along, they've always said their 2024 is going to be even bigger. If you think 2023 has been big for PBC, wait till you see what's going to happen in 2024. So I don't think whatever happens with Showtime, PBC won't be affected too much. Granted, they have to find a new broadcast partner, but from everything they've said all year, they don't seem concerned. Whereas I don't think the fighters will become available. I think they're still going to be tied to BBC. I just think it's a case of, you know, finding a new broadcast partner, and whether that's Fox Sports or Turner or, you know, another broadcaster. Don't think it'll be DAZN. I don't think they've got enough kind of bandwidth to juggle both Matchroom and Golden Boy and PBC. Obviously, it won't be ESPN because they've already got the Top Rank deal that expires next year. But yeah, for me, ESPN seems, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Do you guys think they kind of promote UFC more than they do boxing? Do you think they're more interested in UFC content than
I think so
than Top Rank?
I would say yes, just because I think UFC just performs a little bit better in relation to boxing events. But I don't think from the conversations we've had with people internally I think ESPN is happy with Top Rank. Top Rank's got a pretty.
Oh yeah, I'm not. Just in case anyone from Top Rank is listening, I don't think it's anything to do that. I just think UFC is such a machine.
Yeah, so, they're huge.
You know, they put 40 shows a year, and they don't even need to announce who's on a card before it sells out in a venue. Yeah.
So it's their brand.
Yeah, you're a UFC fan rather than a Jared Anderson fan or a Shakur Stevenson fan or a Teofimo Lopez fan. This is nothing on Top Rank. It's more just how, you know, UFC's just got more dates. And I guess from a broadcast point of view, my point was I just think it's more, you know, reliable to gauge the metrics. You know, a UFC fight night probably tends to deliver, you know, X amount of fans, and it's probably always the same, whereas Top Rank could do 2.5 million for Shakur Stevenson if it's on linear TV or whatever, and then, you know, another fight could do significantly less. You know, I think it would be more fighter and personality orientated rather than brand orientated. It's kind of my only point. It's nothing to do with, like, you know, ESPN's overall happiness with Top Rank, more to do with just how big of a beast the UFC fandom is. But going back, yeah, so my point was PBC, I don't think they're concerned at all with what their near-term future is going to be. And so there's two rumors, isn't there? One is that Showtime is going out of boxing, is going out of sports, period.
Right.
And the other is they'll keep a pay-per-view element. This is just my take. This is nothing I'm hearing from other people. It's just my take. If you're going to keep a pay-per-view element of the, you know, the boxing division, I actually think that hurts PBC, because if you're going to take something to a new broadcaster, why would you leave off Deontay Wilder and Gervonta Davis and Terence Crawford?
Errol Spence.
Errol Spence and Canelo. Okay, so that's six right there, and you could probably have more on pay-per-view. If you fight them twice a year, you've got a pay-per-view every month. It's a real, like, if you're going to keep that on Showtime or Paramount, when you're already getting the impression that they're kind of dipping out of boxing because they're not interested in the show championship. You know, if it's true that they're only going to do pay-per-view, they're not interested in showbox, and they're not interested in Showtime championship boxing. So you're not getting your guys, you know, you're taking a sort of contenders and prospects, and then you have to build them up on another platform. But the unique selling point is the fact that you've got the box office stars, so surely you'd want to bring them with you to whichever new platform it is. So having that, this is just again my take. So I don't think that's a good situation for either company. Paramount, you're either in or you're out, or, you know, PBC, you want to bring everything with you so you can deliver it all on a new broadcaster and have, say, 24 dates and 12 of them are pay-per-view and the other 12 are, you know, whatever, and then maybe another 12 are maybe on your own YouTube channel, you know, where you're building people up and then you can progress through each level of the, you know, the broadcast. But yeah, I don't think it particularly looks too positive. I think if there was if it was just going to be a seamless transition and there was going to be investment in boxing, and surely we would have heard about it by now. Another thing, I actually think it's a this isn't to do with, like, it would be the same. You know, we lost HBO. Broadcasters are promoters as well. You know, they put in an investment in the product. And just to give an example, like BT Sport, when Khabib Nurmagomedov's father, Abdulmanap, died, and then Khabib, you know, there was a question whether he would even return to the sport, because his father was, like, not only his dad, his coach and mentor, and, you know, he had his own fight squad in Dagestan. He did return for one fight, and BT Sport put together this, like, 3-minute clip of really emotional cartoon of, like, you know, Khabib with the I think it's called it's a hat that begins with a P. I don't want to butcher it, but the traditional Dagestan hat, and he was with his dad running up a hill, and then the next scene is him mourning the death of his dad, and then he's running up the hill, you know, like, crying at the bottom of the hill. Then he has a fight, you know, booked, and he goes to the top of the hill by himself. Sounds really simple, but when it was put together on film, you know, it is quite moving. And that just goes viral, and it, you know, that translates, because there's no words on it, that translates in any language. It's as understandable in Russian and, you know, Chechnya as it, and Dagestan as it is in England or, you know, Los Angeles or Vegas. And, you know, HBO did the same with the 24/7 and Showtime did the same with All Access. It naturally builds interest in an event and it sells the product to, you know, potentially new fans. And so to lose anyone who has put together so much time and effort promoting boxing in a, you know, good premium way, I actually think it's a bit of a loss for the sport, because ESPN and Sky Sports in the UK, I kind of see them as quite similar in the fact that, you know, they're more like a news and channel that's designed to build interest in just events that they, you know, have the rights to. And they're more like, you know, they're not just about boxing. They're about like NFL, you know, and basketball and whatever else in the US. And, you know, in the UK, it's all about English Premier League soccer. I don't know. Showtime always felt like something different. And HBO, doesn't matter. I'm not like choosing one over the other, but they both felt like a very premium product. And, you know, you hear the HBO intro music and it's the same if you watch like Sex in the City or Entourage or, you know, right. One of the films they made. It felt very, you know, big to have that on that channel. I think it's a genuine loss for the sport if Paramount aren't going to, continue with that. So regardless of what happens, I hope those people that were involved in that team end up staying, because there's a lot of care and effort that went into producing stuff like that. And hopefully it stays in the sport, because we considering the year we've had, it's wild that a broadcaster wouldn't want to be a part of that, because Showtime Sports alone has generated events that, so there was 150,000 pay-per-view sales for Benavidez Plant. Tank Davis was 1.2, so that's 1.35. And Spence Crawford, let's say it was 650. That's 2 million pay-per-view sales before we get into Canelo and Jermell. Oh, yeah. I'm not sure how... It definitely didn't have anywhere near the buzz as those two events, but the difference was Spence and Crawford were always natural rivals. Tank and Garcia, you know, people might not have thought they were natural rivals on an ability level, but they were when it came to popularity.
Right.
So for me, that was always the fight to make. You know, it just made sense, and it showed in the pay-per-view sales. I think Canelo Jermell might do 400,000 around there. Like maybe 500. I think it would be like a really big Errol Spence fight or something, but that's 2.5 million. And maybe there's the November card, the one we mentioned earlier with Benavidez and Andrade and Jose Benavidez and Jamal. Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe that does 150. So, but either way, you tally all those up, that's 2.65 million at a very conservative level. So that's a lot of pay-per-view sales, like what, an average price point of $90. What's that math? It's hurting my brain even thinking about it. Is it like $240 million?
Yeah, it's a lot.
Granted, a lot of that would have gone to the fighters, but that's still, you know, they still would have made profit surely on some of those cards, especially Tank and Ryan.
Right.
But either way, my point is that's, you know, we've had a banner year for boxing. You go outside of PBC and Showtime and look at Haney, Lomachenko, the double header that Top Rank have announced with Shakur and Edwin, and then Navarrete. That's a nice card on Formula One weekend. And the Phoenix show they had with Navarrete and Valdez, that was a good, you know, Top Rank has been producing steady shows, you know, all year. It's just a bit jarring that we're having such a strong year, and yet the year's going to end, you know, potentially with the exit of one of the, you know, top, the companies that has been doing boxing so proud for 36 years.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Mike, did you have a question?
Just rewinding a little bit, I wanted to, if Al could ask Dana White what his affiliation is with 360.
Yeah, this was the other thing. So when I was talking to Dana White about Callum Walsh, he was full of praise for Tom Loeffler. He called him the best matchmaking in all of boxing, bar none. And the way that he was talking about it, knowing that he had a smirk on his face when I was saying, is Callum Walsh potentially a TKO boxer? I just get the impression Tom Loeffler is a TKO promoter.
Yeah.
Well, that's the rumor I'd heard from guys that I know who fight for 360, that Dana White is kind of like a secret behind the scenes partner with, because why else would he fly from Vegas to the Commerce Casino to attend a fight with no names on there. You know, he quite regularly will go to a 360 promotion show. I know it's on UFC Fight Pass, but
yeah,
for Dana to jump on a plane and to fly to a small casino in California, yeah.
I mean, he honestly, Dana White loves to like shit on certain people, but if he's going to praise someone, it's you know, quite, especially someone that's not like in MMA or UFC, or he was full of praise for Tom Loeffler. I like Tom. This is a guy who promoted the Klitschko brothers and Golovkin, right. And you know, he's a really, really good California. He's based out of the Gold's Gym, isn't he, in Venice?
Yeah. Yeah, his office is in there, I think.
Yeah, Tom's a stand-up dude. So, and the show that it was actually Callum Walsh's second fight, but I'm sure Callum Walsh might be wrong, but I'm sure he was the main event. Like, mm-hmm. it was his very first fight for Tom for a 360 promotions card. I think he'd only fought once. You know, made his debut. Tom saw him, wanted to sign him, brought him into 360. But the event was probably 2,000 people. But there was barbecue on the deck. You know, there was music. It was a really cool. It was one of the coolest small hall shows that I've been to in my life. But maybe it was because I was so far removed from England. Like, you get used to being what a small hall show is, you know, in your neck of the woods, and then seeing it, you know, in a sun-kissed area that you wouldn't really think you'd ever end up in. Maybe that was part of it as well. But yeah, Tom puts together cool shows. It's not too surprising that Dana White be full of praise for him. But yeah, just again, this is just my take reading on the situation. The fact that, you know, Callum Walsh looks like he's either going to box for TKO or maybe he's going to fight in the UFC. There's definitely something there, because otherwise Dana would have just shut it down. And it just seems like he, you know, if there's going to be a TKO group, boxing division, whatever it's called, Dana White wouldn't be the promoter. He's got way too much on his plate with UFC. You know, he is now reporting into, I think, 11 board members.
Right.
And then he's also reporting into, obviously, shareholders and things like that. So he's got his hands full with UFC. He's got his hands full with Contender Series, The Ultimate Fighter, Road to UFC, all of these, you know, MMA kind of things that funnel into his main promotion in the UFC. He's hasn't got time to promote boxing. You know, who does? Tom Loeffler is already doing it with 360 promotions. It just seems like that's potentially a move that might happen, if they do go for boxing. And if they do, I think that's great for the sport. You know, imagine Tom Loeffler with the backing of a $21 billion company.
Yeah, that'd be huge.
I'll as a dig at British boxing, then he has a little dig at small hall British boxing there, you know. A little savage today.
I've actually boxed in York Hall. That just shows how bad York Hall is.
And was it as hot as people say?
I'm only joking. York Hall's cool. I've got no problem with York Hall. Actually, I have got a problem with York Hall. You buy a drink at the bar and you can't take it into your actual seat.
What? So,
I know. It's dumb. You know, but this is because like British people like to drink, but at the same time, a lot of us just can't handle our drink. We just don't know what to say. Stop. I think it's probably more like, you know, but then also you're making it worse, because it's like you've got to down your drink right now. You drink it. Oh, next fight's in. Neck your pint at the bar and then go back to your seat.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. You would think, yeah, get your drink, go back to your seat.
I think it's just a York Hall thing. It's not like that in every venue. But yeah, if you don't know, Danny, York Hall's got like a balcony as well, so you can look over the top at the ring. It's quite a good vantage point.
That's interesting. Well, I'll keep asking those questions of Dana White. We know in the press conferences with him, we know you're one of the main guys to ask those boxing related questions. And obviously he's been talking boxing for quite a few years now. But the fact that you kind of got him to say yes, and he gave you a long pause and stuff, you know, there's something going on behind the scenes. But you know, every time you get a chance, you got to keep asking those questions for the boxing. The boxing aficionado over here, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And I'll come back on and say what it's all about. I think it might go quiet now, because it's like the best time to ask Dana stuff is when things are relevant, you know, and when it's relevant to kind of his business.
Right.
So, yeah, the next time it would really be relevant is just before, probably just after Callum fights, and then get his take on, you know, how he enjoyed the show and if he's looking forward to promoting it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Al, once again, We appreciate you coming here on the Last Round Podcast. Go ahead and plug all the places that you're at now. We know, you know, a couple months ago you came on and talked about your new ventures. I think you've added a couple more, like we mentioned at the beginning of the show, since then. So go ahead and plug whatever you got.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me on. I always love coming on. I really want to come on again. As many times as you have me, but certainly for the Christmas show. You can see me at Alan Dawson Sport on all channels, even ones I don't really even use, like Threads. But yeah, Twitter I'm still quite active on. I'm the news editor and writer at ProBox TV. For the big events, I'm going to probably be covering some things, UFC and boxing, for the Mirror, because they're launching in the US. I've got a column at the Sporting Tribune that's going quite nicely. Send some videos to Fight Hype. So I might try and do some more long form stuff with this is what I really liked about this fight week, actually, just like kind of building on relationships with certain figures in the industry. Like, I was really getting on with Bob Santos and his team, Mario Barrios's coach. So I'm going to try and do gym visits with those guys once every while. Certainly this week, to catch up with like Mario, because I don't think Mario did, unless I missed it, I don't think Mario did any post-fight press in the media room. So to go and get Bob on him. And Leonard Ellaby, seeing all like Kermel, Moten come through, definitely want to go to the Mayweather gym. So I'm going to try and get like long form. You know, whatever you like to read, go to ProBox TV and the Mirror, and my stuff on the Mirror. But if you prefer watching stuff, then I'm going to try and do pretty much exactly the same interview, but send it through, you know, pretty much unedited and unspoiled and raw on Fight Hype.
Absolutely. Mike, before we sign off once again for this week, go ahead and let them know where they can find us and follow us.
At The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. And be sure to join us next week. We'll be previewing Zanabek against Vincenzo Gulateri. Also, Keyshawn Davis is on that card. And then Sunday the 15th on Showtime, Tim Zhu against Brian Mendoza.
Yeah, yeah. Could be a future Charlo opponent. They asked him about that, but he wants Crawford. So we'll see. We'll see how that pans out in the next coming months or so. So for our guest of the week, and reporter, journalist Alan Dawson, who might have broke the record and coming on as a guest. We got to double check that and get back to you guys possibly next week with that figure. For my co-host Michael Shepard, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round Podcast.